Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. It is a pleasure to be with you, and if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And by the way, I am going to get to Kate Brown and her maskless performance at a lesbian, bisexual, transgender event in Washington, D.C., but let me give you a couple of moments because I want to get to that. There are a couple of other things I want to get to first. First of all, we've taken Kate Brown's status at that Washington, D.C. event where she was hobnobbing and says now, oh, I was wearing a mask unless I was eating or unless I was taking photos. Well, there are other photos that show otherwise, Kate. We understand your lips are moving and we can see them without the mask. And when your lips are moving, like with most Democrats, you're telling a lie. But I decided to make it today's Twitter poll. Is Oregon trying to hide the fact that it's planning to make COVID mask rules permanent? Now, understand that Oregon and Washington, two of the three states served by our Radio Northwest network for the past 21 years, they stand alone, almost alone. There are a total of five states in the entire United States. 10% of the 50 states have mask rules. But only Oregon has mask rules where the governor is proposing to make them permanent. And here's where it gets even better. The five states are Oregon and then Nevada, Hawaii, California, and Washington State. And until a few weeks ago, Oregon had an outdoor mask rule on top of that. And if you ask yourself, because you live here in the Northwest, you say, well, isn't the rest of the country just like this? No, it's not. The other 45 states do not have indoor mask rules. And if you say, well, how is that possible? You say, well, for the most part, it's because they don't have Democrats running the show, like Oregon and Washington with Kate Brown and Jay Inslee. Oregon now wants to make the temporary mask rule permanent. Now, here's why. And the folks under Kate Brown are trying to tell you one of those really sneaky, sleazy lies. They say, we're not actually going to make them permanent. Well, I guess if you were to say, is any rule written by the government capable of being rewritten? And the answer to that is yes. You can even rewrite parts of the U.S. Constitution. It's got a very long, complicated process attached to it, but you can put in amendments to the Constitution. You can eliminate laws that you have passed in previous years. You can create new laws that never existed in recent years. So every single rule is not permanent by that definition. But that's what Kate Brown's bureaucracy is trying to say. They're saying, we're not going to make it permanent. It's just that right now we have a temporary rule, and we have to go through this process of renewing it every 180 days. Frankly, I don't think they should have the rule at all. But having said that, if you're going to have the rule, and every 6 months or so, 180 days, not quite 6 months, you have to go back and look at the rule again and then repass it again, that's the best kind of sunset in the world. In other words, if you can't re-justify that rule every 6 months, you shouldn't have the rule. There's a reason that some rules are temporary. So what does Kate Brown want to do? They want to make a permanent rule. Now, I've asked you the question that way because I think for the purpose of our conversation today, they're talking about going from a temporary rule to a permanent rule. Well, here's what Dr. Paul Cieslak says. He's the medical director for communicable diseases. He says, the fact that it's made permanent does not mean it will be in effect forever. K2 News quotes him as saying, permanent means indefinite. It doesn't necessarily mean permanent. You know, I love this. This is when Democrats and the people who work for them start to sound like Bill Clinton. Well, you know, it depends on what the meaning of is. He says we can repeal it as well, but we are only allowed to have a temporary rule for 180 days. Anything that goes beyond that 180 days, we cannot extend it. Yes, and that is exactly the point. If you make it a permanent rule, then you can just kick back and say, we don't have to go back and renew this thing every 6 months and re-justify the need for it. Because an awful lot of people in Oregon, and I would imagine if Inslee tries this in Washington State, the same folks will ask the same question. Why do you need this rule at all when 45 states do not have an indoor mask rule? So I've made that today's Twitter poll. You can find it at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And I'm really tempted. I want to talk about what happened on I-5 and the carjacking and Ted Wheeler feeling sorry for a really dastardly criminal. I'm really tempted because we always say we're going to take naysayers first. I didn't think I was going to get a naysayer this quickly today. But, Ryan, welcome to the program as a naysayer. And if you want to join us, folks, it's 866-A-LARS. Ryan, what do you and I disagree about today?
Pretty much everything.
Okay, everything. We'll start with your favorite thing you disagree with me about.
So I'm going to just go ahead and address the first thing you said here, which was the mask mandate. Like, you realize that Oregon has one of the lowest cases of COVID-19 deaths in the country. And
not per capita.
Stop. Don't interrupt me. It's because we have mask mandates.
Ryan, are you aware there are now 142 medical studies that show the masks don't do any good at all? You might not be aware of that, but I thought I'd bring that into the conversation.
Ryan, you know what's hilarious? Are you a medical doctor?
No, that's why I cite medical studies. I don't have to be a medical doctor to read medical studies and see what their conclusions are. Ryan, I don't have to be the smartest guy in the room. I just have to get their work into the room.
Right. Are you a journalist?
Yes.
Are you? Do
yes.
you go out and actually, like, wait, stop. Do you go out and actually dig up news?
Yes.
Find it, investigate
yes.
it? Or
yes.
do you just talk about the news that's in the news?
No. We dig up, we break news on this show on a regular basis. And those who listen to it know that. We bring people on and do interviews that you aren't going to hear on any other medium. You aren't going to hear it elsewhere in radio. You aren't going to hear it. You aren't going to see it on television. And we ask questions that don't get asked elsewhere. So, yes.
I listen to you, and I don't hear anything breaking. All you do is talk about.
Ask my producers.
All you do is talk about.
Because
all you do is talk over people. You talk over people.
No.
And then
no, well, only when. No, but Ryan, you haven't heard the inter. I mean, last week we broke at least three or four. Last week. Last week we broke at least three or four good-sized stories. You don't count on a gigantic one every week.
Quote them.
What?
Because one of the things that I get really tired of is that you say things. You're like, hey, we broke three stories last week.
Yeah.
But then you just go on, not stop. Then you just go on and talk about more stuff.
It's not my style. I got to tell you something, Ryan. We're up against a break, but it's not my style to sit there and every day say, hey, guess what we did last week? The show isn't about me. It's about the people who listen to it. We try to get good information for people. And then when we get it, we don't sit there and pat ourselves on the back for the next 6 weeks. Wasn't that a great story we broke last week? We don't do that kind of stuff. You either hear it or you don't. And if you don't hear it today, you can always go to the website. But Ryan, yes to all your questions, and no, I disagree with you about the mask mandate, and 45 other states agree with me. Back in just a moment with the nonsense on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right, you know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
By the way, we hear that Roosevelt High School in the Portland area is in lockdown, and we're going to find out more details as they're available. That's all we know. Roosevelt High School in lockdown, a couple of other schools in lockout. If you have any direct information on that as a parent or as a student, we'd love to hear from you at 866-HEY-LARS. But in the nonsense, Oregon's lame duck governor, Queen Kate of the Brown Shirts, never seems to tire of reminding folks that she has two different kinds of rules. Rules for her subjects that she makes up without consulting their representatives. And the rules that elites like her follow or do not follow, it's all up to them. This past weekend is a great example. Kate Brown went to Washington, D.C. to hobnob with her fellow elites at an LGBT event. By the way, that does not stand for Let's Go Brandon Today, although it should. It turns out that House Speaker Tina Kotek attended the event as well. She's a far-left Democrat who hopes to succeed Brown in the governor's office after Brown is term-limited out at the end of next year. Brown and Kotek come from a high-risk area, so Doesn't that mean they ought to be masked up? Now, Washington, D.C. does not have a mask mandate, like most of America, Kate Brown. But no COVID masks in the pictures that Brown sent from the event. She claims that she was masked up at all times when she was not eating or taking pictures with people. Wasn't that exactly when you need to be masked up, according to Kate Brown? I don't agree with the mask rules. I don't like them. But if Kate Brown's going to make up these rules, shouldn't she at least follow them? Back at home in Oregon, parents whose kids have to spend their days in class masked up, no matter what, were not pleased to see Kate Brown going maskless in our nation's capital, to say the least. Oregon is one of just five states out of 50 that still has a mask rule for indoors. Not only that, the current rules are temporary, but Queen Kate's bureaucracy is now demanding that the mask rules be made permanent. That would make Oregon the only state out of 50 with permanent rules, and who knows where they're going to end. So, permanent rules for her subjects, and Queen Kate can do as she likes. Liberal hypocrisy, absolutely. Democrats have double standards, or they'd simply have no standards at all. Now, from Getter, Larry writes in, Lars, good evening, Lars. Portland TV just indicated Brown photographed at an LGBTQ POC event in D.C. Did Oregon tax dollars pay for this trip? I believe the event was aimed at promoting LGBTQ POC candidacy for political office. I assume she'll be hosting or attending a similar event for straight candidates. Oops, was that profiling? Was that sexist? How about racist or maybe domestic terrorism? My goodness, all that and she had no mask? I guess I'll see the inside of a lot of public facilities. Her mask mandate will not work on me, nor most of those I know. And from Facebook, yeah, we got word about a gun event, an alleged gun event, last week in Washington State. Then it turns out that the young man who made it is now going to be in trouble because, well, he lied to the cops and reported a false report. Our question of the day, and this is a good one from Lisa. Lars, I've been out of prison for 5 years now after spending 5 years inside for a first-time drug offender offense at the age of 43. I had worked for the federal government as a law enforcement dispatcher, and I also volunteered with my local fire department for years. I'm a good person. I was punished for having an illness. The narcotics officer was angry at me. That's really why I was sent to prison, not because I'm a bad person. I've worked at a hotel cleaning, toilets, paid off my fine of $7,000. I went back to school to get a business office specialist certificate on my own. I've tried every opportunity to get a job that would allow for me to completely support myself without my son helping out. Nobody wants to hire me. I don't know what else to do. Can you help me? I'm going to put the word out. Because oftentimes when I get appeals like that, somebody writes to me and says, I'll give that lady a chance. So send me an email. I'll forward it on to her. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, I want to put down two Daily Grills today. Number one, to the city of Portland and its feckless leader, Ted Wheeler, also the police commissioner. Two more people were killed in Portland. That pushes the city's homicide total to 83. It is an outstanding and hideous record, and they get the Daily Grill for that. Second, brought up by my colleague, John Canzano, he points out that ESPN holds the radio and TV rights for this year's Major League Soccer Cup for the first time in league history. They're not going to allow either team to carry the title game on local radio in English. They can carry it in Spanish. They cannot carry it in English. Portland and New York have complained to no avail per the source. Again, that is a first for Major League Soccer. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus online at RiverCityUSA.com/careers. This one signed a fan. Do Governor Brown and her left-wing ilk realize their sanctuary state policies are like an open invitation for drug cartels to come to Oregon and start their marijuana grows? They've already characterized those employees as slaves, which will probably mean they'll be immune from prosecution and deportation. And duh, does she think they are not aware of the possible immunity? Same for the rent compensation policies. Renters know they can't be evicted, so why pay the rent? Here in Salem, we hope to see a new governor with common sense. But we do not remember the last time a governor used common sense. When was that? Carry on the good work, a fan. Well, that would have been Victor Atiyah. To your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS on the Radio Northwest Network. That's 866-439-5277. James from Washington State, welcome to the program. What's on your mind on this Tuesday? James? I think we're going to have to get James to a cleaner cell line. Let's go to Chris instead. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Lars. This permanent mandate mask thing, this is so nuts. We live down here in Rogue River, and we're much more rural, and we take care of ourselves. We do a good job. We follow the rules and the laws. And, you know, when one of our stores wants to ask us to put on the masks, we do. But what I'm really tired of is all these folks who come down to enjoy our beautiful area from Portland or from Eugene, where the big population bases are. They come down, no masks, no nothing. How do we know they're not carrying some terrible disease that's spread to us? And now our governor wants to make this permanent on us. We live here every day. We chop our wood. We take care of our children. We take care of our businesses. This is ridiculous.
Can I give you, I'll give you my reaction to that. First of all, I don't like the mask mandate. Secondly, if you want to wear a mask for yourself, go ahead and wear it. That answers two just general questions. Then, as far as people coming to visit your community, Chris, are you aware of how many people like to get out of the big cities like Seattle and Portland because they hate the rules like that? And they say, gosh, when you go out to more sensible parts of the state, they don't push those rules on you. And they aren't all coming to your community for that, but a lot of people are. I've had the reaction myself. Isn't it great to go to a state or a county or a city where they're not pushing all this stuff down your throats? And believe me, we're on your side on this one. And Kate Brown, the hypocrite, she has shown her true colors, and apparently she feels she doesn't have to follow the rules, but she wants everybody else to. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You probably followed the news we talked about last week with Chris Cuomo being pushed out at CNN. That apparently was not because of his bad journalism or trying to help out his brother. CNN claims it was because of a sexual harassment allegation. Well, in the Pacific Northwest, we've had some really bad sexual harassment scandals, but since they're happening in a majority Democrat state with a Democrat governor and Democrat House and Senate, you'd expect, well, they're going to take it seriously. I mean, nobody talks a good game about sexual harassment like the Democrats. Unfortunately, in many cases, it turns out to be just talk. So I thought we'd talk to Kim Sordell, who is a civil rights employment law attorney, about what's going on in Oregon state government, where they appear to be trying, and Kim, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, they appear to be trying to take their fairly major sexual harassment scandal and their really terrible rules for handling these things. They're trying to sweep this stuff under the rug. Do you think I'm wrong in that conclusion?
Absolutely not. What I've seen them do is pat themselves on the back for, you know, being so against sexual harassment. And then they turn a blind eye to it and they victimize people who come forward. They threaten them. They attack their careers. They attack their integrity. And everyone's being silent about it. Other than Peter Courtney and Tina Kotek pointing fingers at the other lawmakers, nobody's talking about it.
Well, and yet, do you mind my pointing out that Peter Courtney had part of this sexual harassment scandal happen with one of his high-ranking aides in his own office, didn't he?
Oh, yep, he did. He told her when he found out she was dating someone in the legislature, he told her to either resign or be fired.
Resign or be fired. So she, a woman working for Peter Courtney, wasn't free to choose whoever she wanted to choose to date, or was there a real workplace issue that should have been addressed by the boss saying, you either stop dating the person or quit your job?
Well, you don't tell someone to stop dating the person.
I kind of thought, I'm not even a lawyer, and I thought I understood part of it. But Courtney did exactly that, didn't he?
Yes, she did. And so did Tina Kotek when she heard of sexual harassment problems. She attacked the victim. She told Sarah Gelder that she wasn't likable, therefore this shouldn't be investigated. This isn't going to go anywhere. She told my client to fix it when she found out that all the sexual harassment complaints were being ignored. And now they're trying to point fingers at someone else.
Would you mind telling my audience about your client and the circumstances of your client right now?
Sure. My client was brought on after the legislature was caught bearing sexual harassment. Bully did a thorough investigation and found that multiple people, including Kotek and Courtney, had been burying sexual harassment complaints. So they signed an agreement with Bully promising to clean up their act. And one of the things that they were going to do is start up a legislative equity office that would be completely independent. And they wouldn't have the bad actors involved at all, such as Dexter Johnson, who had been retaliating against people and burying complaints. And they hired an interim person who did nothing for a year and a half but bury complaints, as far as I can tell. And then when they brought my client on to take over the office, he immediately saw there was no office. There were no record keeping. There were no complaints. Bills were stacked up. There was nothing going on.
Now, that's Nate Monson, right?
That's Nate Monson.
Now,
and so
he
but
Kim, just so people understand this, you have a legislature that's been beset with harassment scandals. You have people in the upper echelons like Tina Kotek, who wants to be the next governor, and Peter Courtney, who's the current Senate president, way past his expiration date. And they don't do anything about it. So they create an office, and they have somebody work in the office for a year and a half who has no records at the end of a year and a half. I mean, you'd at least be able to say, well, we have a list of everybody who came to us with a complaint. We have the report that was written up of what their complaint was, and then we have a record of how we resolved it, how we said there is a complaint, there isn't, it should be investigated, it shouldn't, and then you'd have a record of what happened. None of that was there?
None of that was there, and part of the Bowley settlement agreement was that they would have a record-keeping process. And when he showed up, there was furniture, a Cheetos bag on the floor, an empty computer from the former equity officer, and she handed him a Post-it note of some complaints that were out there that she had never handled.
That's it.
That was it.
So this person got paid to do what? Just sit around for 18 months and collect a check?
Oh, I think she was paid to bury complaints is what I think. I think she was, you know, Courtney's chief of staff apparently said that this person who buried all the complaints was a great political choice.
Because she buried complaints so well.
I guess so.
And now Nate Monson is saying, I'm going to sue the legislature because he's going to show that when he walked in, there were no records. Nobody had kept track of it. Part of the legislature's job, just like the Congress at the federal level, is oversight of state agencies and especially its own affairs. And I'm not using affairs in a pun, but they, you know, they've done none of this stuff. And he's saying, if you don't resolve this, I'm going to take you to court, and everybody's going to hear about your dirty laundry.
Yes. Well, let's back up a little bit. He started complaining. He complained to DOJ attorney Mark Abrams, and Mark Abrams said things like, "We're fucked."
And what? Stop! Drop it! Dump it! Dusty, make sure that got dumped. Kim, I don't know if you know, you don't know FCC law, but the FCC is really tough. I've only had two members of Congress ever use that word on the show, and occasionally an average, you know, non-elected official person does it, but we can't. He said we are blanked, right?
And he also said, other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? Did he go to Ellen Rosenblum and say, hey, this office has been doing nothing for a year and a half, and I'm supposed to defend these cases? Did Ellen do anything about it? Did he do anything about it? It doesn't appear so. So then he complained to Jessica Kneeling, who is the HR director. She told him to fix it. She said, I'm not surprised, and figured out. He went to Tina Kotek's office, Peter Courtney's office. They said, fix it, just fix it. And when he continued to complain, Jessica Kneeling went after him and did a smear job on him. So he went to the press, and they retaliated against him again by releasing his personnel files to the media and to everyone in the Capitol.
That's got to bring a lawsuit, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I hope not, but I'm told that the Department of Justice doesn't settle claims until they've billed enough hours on it.
Well, good. They can build all the hours. Then you can take it to trial and the whole state can hear what's really been going on in Salem. Doesn't that sound like a good... I mean, to me as a citizen, I'd rather do that and take it to court and have them then get a shellacking in court and we find out what's going on rather than somebody in Salem gets to write a check with somebody else's money and say that just solves it, because that sounds like the same kind of solution they've been applying to sexual harassment.
Well, I'll tell you... I'm not going to be quiet along the way. If they decide to drag their heels, drag my client through painful litigation, dig through all his records, look at all of his social media, look at his medical records, depose him, make him suffer that, no, I'm going to continue to investigate. And each new piece of evidence that I find, I'm going to put it out there for the voters and for the public to see. This isn't going to be we wait until we're in trial.
Does that mean you get to depose people like Tina Kotek and Peter Courtney?
Yes.
Oh, under oath?
Yes.
Penalty and of Mark perjury. Abrams. I love the sound of that.
Mark Abrams and Dexter Johnson and Jessica Kneeling, all of those people will be deposed if they make my client go through the discovery process. The other thing, I've been talking to DOJ employees, and they've told me that Mark Abrams doesn't get involved until after depositions are over. And he's in charge of employment litigation, so he's going to make this drag on.
Unbelievable. That's Kim Sordell, who's a civil rights employment law attorney. We'll be talking to her a lot in the months ahead. Back in just a moment. It's a Tuesday, and it's the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to jump into the best conversation and talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. I would be remiss if I did not mention that today is the 80th anniversary of the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. We should remember those who lost their lives that day and those who served in this country in the Second World War to defeat Japan and actually to bring Japan into the community of nations as a reasonably well-behaved country ever since World War II. For anybody who tells you that, no, you can't change ideology, take a look at Japan before World War II and take a look at Japan after World War II and compare the two and then tell me again you can't change ideology. Now, I have a serious question to ask you, and I'll have to admit that I have a bias in this question. My granddaughter, whose name is Payson, she's 5 years old, she'll be six next year. Someday she may want to compete in sports. I don't know. It's her choice. The only competition that Grandpa ever did was swimming in competition in junior high for a couple of years. But if Payson decides that she wants to be an athlete, I'm all for it. So here's the question I want to ask you, and this one deserves some serious consideration. I've been asking it for the last several years because this issue just gets worse and worse and worse. Are you ready as a parent or a grandparent to tell the young girls in your family, whether they're high school age, middle school age, maybe they're college age, are you ready to tell those young ladies, just forget about any kind of sports competition? Because it's not going to happen. Are you ready to do that? Especially in a country that has something called Title IX. And the whole point of Title IX was that at one point, major universities especially would have sports programs for young men. They had football, they had basketball, they had baseball, and they didn't really offer much of anything. Certainly not the equivalent for young ladies. Now, I think in some cases, Title IX has gone too far. And I'll be honest about that. It's gone too far in this way. There are universities where they say, well, if you have a football team and it allows 50 or 60 young men to have an opportunity to play sports, and you get more than that number who turn out, and you end up with a team, 50, 60 people on the entire team, that you have to have the same level of participation by young women, even if they choose not to participate in equivalent sports. I think that's taking it too far. However, this is also taking it too far. Let me read what happened this weekend. A 22-year-old transgender swimmer, in other words, this is a biological male who now identifies as a female, and he is a competitive swimmer. Now, in the news reports, they call him her, but the fact is he's a biological male. A 22-year-old transgender swimmer at the University of Pennsylvania continued her dominant performance this season, setting numerous pool, meet, and program records at a three-day event in Ohio last weekend. Leah Thomas, biological male, identifies as female, blew away her competition Friday night in the 500-yard freestyle preliminaries and finals at the Zippy International Invitational at the University of Akron. In the finals, Thomas notched a winning time of 4 minutes, 34 seconds, and 6 tenths. Good enough for a new Ivy League record. And you say, well, that's fantastic. It's great to see athletes set new records. Here's the problem. The swimmer continued smashing records on Saturday with a nearly 7-second victory in the 200-yard freestyle with a time of 1:41.93, representing the fastest finish in the country. And if you say, well, that's great, here's the problem. The reason it's the fastest is that Leah Thomas is competing as a woman, but in fact has the muscles and the skeleton and the skills, the muscle skills, of being a biological male. Over the weekend, Thomas set a new program meet and pool record in the 1,650-yard freestyle. She finished that race in 15:59.71, 38 seconds ahead of the second-place finisher, teammate Anna Calandazri. Before her transition, Thomas completed two full seasons at Penn as a man. NCAA rules mandate at least 1 year of testosterone suppression treatment to be eligible to compete as a woman. Swimming is a huge part of my life and who I am. I've been a swimmer since I was 5. Being trans has not affected my ability to do this sport, and being able to continue is very rewarding. Of course it's rewarding. You beat the competition by 38 seconds. Now, I'll tell you something. I'm not a medical expert, as has been pointed out by more than one caller to the show, but the studies that have been done show that even after you've had testosterone suppression, the inherent advantage built into a biological male, even one who's taking those treatments, mean that he, in many cases, will be able to absolutely thrash the competition when competing as a woman, even though he was born a biological man. And even with the testosterone suppression, it should tell you something when anybody in a sport that is measured in 100ths of a second finishes 38 seconds ahead of the second place swimmer. Now, are you going to have that conversation with the young ladies in your family? And when they say, I'm going to go out and try out for track and field, or I'm going to be a swimmer, or I'm going to play any sport out there where a biological male will be able to best them, even a former biological male, are you going to have that conversation? Or are you going to have a conversation with your members of Congress and your state legislature and say, we cannot allow the destruction of women's sports simply to satisfy this tiny part of the population that has an inherent advantage? Makes no sense. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. You know, we set up this interview last week after what happened, the terrible crime that happened in Michigan at Oxford County, at Oxford High School, where a young man is now accused. He has a right to his day in court, but I have a feeling he's going to be found guilty because he was caught with the gun in his hand that his dad had bought the previous Friday. He brought the gun to school, allegedly, and allegedly murdered 4 people. His parents are now charged as well. And I'm glad to introduce Rick Puente, who's the vice president of the Oregon School Resource Officers Association. And Rick knows that I'm biased in favor of school resource officers, and I've been dismayed, I think would be the mildest way of saying, the decision of many schools to boot those SROs out. But, Rick, do you know there's been another incident just today? And I wanted to bring it to your attention because it's so new, you may not have heard about it. Welcome to the program, by the way.
Yes, thank you, Lars. Thank you for having me, and look forward to having this such important discussion. So
a couple of hours ago, I got word that Roosevelt High School in Portland, in this case, had been gone into lockdown. A couple of other nearby schools went into lockout, where they simply locked the doors to keep anybody outside from coming in. And we wondered what it is. First indications, and we may find out more, is that there was a robbery involving one of the students at Roosevelt High School, robbing another student, they say off campus. Now, I don't know if off campus was in the parking lot or out in the street out in front, but in any case, there was a robbery with a weapon by one high school student aimed at and successfully ripping off another student. Nobody was injured, thank God. The classrooms are locked up, the lights are off, the students and the teachers are hiding out of sight. And what worries me, and what I think what worries a lot of parents, is the folks who run the schools that ought to be the local community have decided to give the boot to school resource officers. What do you say about that?
Well, I think the first part, I mean, it's so sad to hear that these incidents continue to happen. But as you speak about that, Lars, I think the first thing that stands out to me is when we talk about SROs is the first aspect of presence. An SRO is an immediate presence of safety, security, resource, support for our school administrators, for the safety of our students. And so when we remove them from the schools, we take away that element of presence. Presence has a lot of power and a lot of impact, especially when it comes to safety. And I think that the focus of removing SROs removes such a key element of that, especially in our schools.
Is it fair to say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but if we have incidents like this where some student with a weapon robs another student near the school, that if the school resource officer had been there, that that student, that robbery might not have happened, and that we're likely to see more of these criminal acts because school resource officers are being removed?
We have seen in instances where an SRO is present in a school, that it has limited crime, it has limited behaviors. I mean, we still see it in society. We have police departments, but we still have crime. So it still happens. But I think the element of presence of SROs in our school helps deter that. So absolutely.
What's it going to take to return SROs to schools where the woke, politically correct leadership have decided to push them away?
Well, it's unfortunate. I think right now we're experiencing that even now with the tragedy in Michigan. Of course, now everything on the forefront is, are our schools safe? Are we doing enough? And so the shifting goes back because of a tragic event. And we should not be reactive in that. We should be proactive. And part of that proactive aspect is making sure that our communities, our school communities, our school boards and our school districts are taking the proactive measures. And part of that is, and when you talk about school safety, it's an umbrella. I mean, and SROs are just one element of school safety overall.
Okay, but are you seeing any shift like that here in the Northwest, shift back to SROs and police presence on campus?
Right now it's a mix, Lars. I think, with Portland removing their SROs and several other districts kind of following suit, I think that districts are a little, there's a handful of districts that are really taking a stance to just really stop and make a wise decision about that. And so I'm really, as I, have gone around the state in the past and just connected with different communities, I believe if school districts were to step back and take a look at the whole picture of what school safety is and the element that SROs play in that, I think that we will see a comeback of some SROs in maybe a different fashion, right? Maybe in a different form.
Rick, what different form could there be other than an accredited police officer on campus? I mean, do we have to have them wear a clown suit or what? What do they have to do?
Shifting the mentality of letting the police do what they need to do and be a partner with our school administration, our school districts, to enhance the safety culture of our schools. And right now that's not happening. There's definitely a divide, and we need to bridge that divide. We need to bridge that gap. And that's part of our focus as the Oregon School Resource Officers Association is providing training and building relationships, building a bridge between school education and school safety and law enforcement. And we continue to see that to be a huge challenge.
Is it going to take more kids dying in a school like what happened in Michigan to bring cops back to campus?
God, I hope not. I hope not. I know that in my career, working with students and schools and school safety, it always. We unfortunately, it takes a tragedy like this for people to even focus back or look back to say, hey, what are we doing? And I'd rather us be a proactive. I always say that law enforcement is a reactive entity with a proactive mentality, and I don't think that that's going on right now within our community of our schools.
See, Rick, I don't think it's happening either, and I think it's going to take a terrible tragedy. And just the fact that if you look at this kid in Evan Crumley in Michigan, he's looking at life in prison. And here in the Pacific Northwest, at least in Oregon, he'd be looking at being locked up from, he'll probably be convicted when he's 16 or 17. He'll sit in custody till he's 25. He'll walk out with no criminal record at all and be able to say he's never been convicted of a crime. And the difference between those two states is just absolutely gigantic. I'm convinced that you're not going to see the change. And SROs welcome back to in the big city areas until we actually see something really bad happen. And everybody's going to say, well, gee, it's too bad that happened. And you say, well, then let's start asking. I want my reporter friends who do straight news reporting, I want them to start asking. When something like Michigan happens here, how are you going to answer the decision to get rid of SROs? That's Rick Puente, who's vice president of the Oregon School Resource Officers Association. I'll get to your phone calls and your emails next. And I wanted you to listen to something a European politician is saying about what's going on in Australia.
I'm a German, and we once asked our grandparents how they could have just stood by in silence, allowing a horrific totalitarian regime to come about. Anyone could have known. All I had to do was open their eyes and take a look.
That is Christine Anderson, and this is the Lars Larson Show. Now, Christine Anderson is a woman I don't know, but she's a member of the European Parliament, the EU Parliament. And she's one of the few that are standing up and objecting to what is going on in Australia, seems like the best example of this. Now, much of the world has been beset by governments that have badly fumbled the response to the COVID virus. But in Australia, they've gone into lockdowns, they've had mandates, and I think that all of us who live in places where there are lockdowns and mandates can reflect on what is going on. Australia seems like one of these worst case examples, where Australia right now is seeing protests by thousands and thousands of people. And this is fairly unusual. I pointed out to people when they've said, Lars, why don't conservatives get out and stage these mass protests that we always see from the left? I said, it just doesn't tend to be the way we respond to problems. We try to work within the system. But they have had massive protests in Australia because the government there is seeking to pass. They have some emergency authorities that run out about a week from now. And what they want is they want a semi-permanent set of restrictions that include lockdowns, mask requirements, vaccine mandates, and all the rest. And I have to give credit to somebody like Christine Anderson, who is a highly placed government official. She is an elected official from Germany. She points something out. She says, this is not about the good guys. Take a listen to this.
At no point in history have the people forcing others into compliance been the good guys. The welfare of humanity has always been the alibi of tyrants. Do you not realize that this vaccine does not protect you from COVID? It does, however, protect you from governmental oppression. For now, that is.
Now, that again, that's Christine Anderson. And what she says is she makes a comparison. I'm sure some people are going to get their backs up about it because she compares it to the Nazi regime. Now, the Nazi regime was a group of mass murderers, and we have not seen mass murder committed, I guess not yet, by governments around the world that have responded to COVID. But she makes that comparison, and frankly, she makes a good one. Take a listen to that.
I'm a German, and we once asked our grandparents how they could have just stood by in silence, allowing a horrific totalitarian regime to come about. Anyone could have known. All I had to do was open their eyes and take a look. The vast majority chose not to. So, what will you tell your grandchildren? Will you tell them you didn't know? Will you tell them you were just following orders? You need to understand, it isn't about breaking the fourth wave. It is all about breaking people.
And I want to point out to you that the same kind of thing, not as bad as Australia, is going on right now. Just today we got news that Joe Biden's mandate to tell all federal contractors you must demand that your employees get vaccinated or you must fire them, that has been struck down by a federal court as illegal. And in fact, a lot of Joe Biden's mandates, the OSHA mandate, was struck down by a federal court. In other words, the government folks they're in a position where they basically said, we don't care. We're just going to go ahead and do it until we get caught, until we get dragged into court. In New York City right now, the mayor of New York City, who's on his way out the door, while he's there, Bill de Blasio is going to try this. He's just announced a very short-term notice vaccine mandate for the entire city. And businesses are saying, you can't do this to us on such short notice. And yet the question, again, from somebody like Christine Anderson, is are you going to stand up? Listen to that.
I'm a German.
No. Well, we'll have to get to it later. But
Australia does not need a no-COVID strategy. What Australia needs is a no-oppression strategy. So I stand in support with your fight for freedom and democracy. We need to stop our governments from transforming our free and democratic societies into totalitarian regimes. We need to do it now. We need to stand up now.
I totally agree with her. And in fact, from the very beginning of this pandemic, when people would ask me, well, how are we going to ultimately solve this? I said, the solutions are not going to come from Capitol Hill. They're not going to come from your state legislature. They're going to come from individuals, individual people, individual companies, individual organizations, making their own best solution, figuring out, do I want to wear a mask or not? Do I want to get vaccinated or not? And yet there are some within the government, and you know who I'm talking about, who have said, we can't trust people to make decisions for themselves. Now, we got the first taste of that with Obamacare, when the government said everybody should have health care. And when all of us asked, and I asked it multiple times, why don't we let people make up their own minds about whether or not they want to have health care, whether or not they want to buy health insurance, and what kind of insurance do they want to buy? How much do they want to budget for that? And what I was told was, no. We can't let people make their own decisions, because if they make their own decisions, they will decide wrongly. That is the wrong way to do government. It works great in a totalitarian society. That is not yet what America is. I just thought I'd unload that for you and just consider what Christine Anderson has been saying. And she is one of maybe a few people in the among the elected elites within Europe who are actually raising this issue. Let me go to Scott now. Hey, Scott, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Lars. First, I'd like to thank all the service members for serving in the military, especially today. First, I'd like to say I was a volunteer firefighter for 15 years, as well as in the construction industry for about the same amount of time. Anyhow, I had to wear respirators all the time, and they required fit tests. There's two types of fit tests, quantitative and qualitative. There are minor differences. But anyways, what I was getting at is surgical masks are non-certified masks. In order to prevent particulate 0.3 or greater, which is what N95s and P100 masks do, surgical masks are basically to keep blood-borne pathogens from entering, say, a doctor's mouth or from drooling into a patient's surgical site.
Yep.
They say it keeps droplets, and that's what they're concerned about is droplets. Well, droplets is basically drool, cough, spit. And unless you're spitting on somebody, these masks are absolutely 110% pointless. It's all about control, in my opinion. And I just wanted to get that out there. That
I agree with you. And, Scott, this is why I pointed out to people there are a bunch of studies, about 142 of them so far, that have been done over the last year and a half as people have begun to ask, do these masks actually make a difference? And the answer generally is they don't. They don't make any difference at all. But you're right. Do you find out as a public official, an elected governor or city council or county commissioner, even the Congress, you find out that the masks don't make a difference, but they do tell you who's willing to be compliant and who's not willing to be compliant. And for the folks in charge, that tends to be one of the major issues for them, rather than simply saying, why don't we let people make up their own minds? If they say, I'm in a position where I can't, you know, I can't protect myself as well, I've got underlying conditions, then you can make your own decision about whether or not to wear that mask. Back in just a moment. Amen. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Last Christmas, the North Pole was booming. Toys were on all of the shelves. Now Santa can't find any workers, 'cause the government's paying his elves. So Santa came up with a new plan. Since there's not enough toys to go around, he'd deliver the toys to the good girls and boys whose folks didn't vote for this clown. He said Democrats don't deserve Christmas. Looks like old Santa is pissed. Told them Democrats don't deserve Christmas. They're all on one big naughty list.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That is Buddy Brown. And, you know, I had the great good fortune that somebody, one of the listeners to the show, sent me a copy of that song and said, you got to hear this Buddy Brown. So I listened to the song. Then I checked out a few more of his songs. And I thought, I've got to reach out to this gentleman to see if he'll come on and spend a few minutes with us. He hails from the great state of Mississippi. And he joins me now, Mr. Buddy Brown. How you doing, sir?
Hey, pretty good, Lars. I'm about as happy as a tick on a fat dog.
Well, that you have really, you hit it out of the park with that one, as far as I'm concerned, because I've told some of my friends in music, you ought to do some songs that are based on current events and something that's got a catchy tune and kind of gets a point across that a lot of us have been thinking about, which is, in this case, people who don't want to work because the government is paying them not to.
That's right. Yeah, it's getting out of hand, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it does threaten Christmas. I mean, if you don't believe me, take a look at all the, I think we're almost up to 100 ships waiting off the West Coast, and they're full of toys. They just have to unload.
Get your jet ski. I'll be right behind you.
No, so I want to ask you about this. You do quite a number of songs, and they're I don't know if parody is the right way to describe them, but how would you describe them to my audience?
Well, I started out as a Nashville recording artist and had one of the biggest agents in town, and they were shopping me to a record label, and they said, look, you know, we want to sign you, but you got to tone down the conservative stuff, and you got to tone down the political stuff. And I just said, well, hell with it. I'm not going to do that. So fortunately for me, I had a big enough following anyway. We got songs that I really just pour my heart into and I love. But then, you know, it got big enough to where I said, I don't think I'm going to lose anybody if I start, you know, singing about some political stuff. And as soon as I started doing that, everything quadrupled, maybe even more. So at this point, we're just having fun and just, you know, putting it out there on the airways for patriots to listen to.
I got to tell you something, buddy. Everybody who listens to this show knows I like country music. I like rock and roll. And I can't carry a tune in a gunny sack. I can't carry a tune to save my life. And what you just said kind of surprised me, though. Nashville and country music says you have to tone down the conservative stuff. What is that all about?
Country music has gone so woke, it's unbelievable. If you really watch a award show, if you really listen to the music and how we're trying to be universally appealing, you're allowed to sing about three topics: partying, girls, or partying. Yeah, I don't love songs. It's just the topics are so narrow. You're not allowed to sing about real life like Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings used to lay it down. So my generation, you know, that's probably why we're so surface, is because nobody dives deep with this stuff at all. And as soon as you do, you develop a cult-like following, and everybody's hanging on every word. And I'm so passionate about this stuff. And we got listeners everywhere from 9 years old to 89.
Yeah, and you live in a fairly conservative part of the country. I've been to Mississippi a few times. It's a beautiful state. I mean, it's beautiful in a different way than other states. I mean, I like desert states. I like wet states. I mean, Mississippi tends to be a little wetter than normal, but very nice at this time of year. In fact, you guys will probably be doing your barbecues out in the backyard all the way up to Christmas.
You're darn right. And we just got paved roads 2 weeks ago, so we're real pumped about that.
But, you know, this, I guess it says something about our culture when you say you got to have all these, you got to have partying and you're going to have girls. Well, a lot of songs written about partying and girls, probably for hundreds, if not thousands of years. But how about the song? I mean, songs everybody can relate to. I got fired, or I'm threatened with getting fired, or I got divorced, or I'm having money troubles. I mean, those are things everybody can relate to. It doesn't matter which gender you are of the many that are out there now, and it doesn't matter what part of the country you live in or how you like to dress. And yet they've tried to make. Is there any way to push back against this in country music?
I say just the underground circuit. It's actually a pretty massive circuit, and there's myself included. I mean, I've had 300 million. Views on all our platforms without radio, without a manager, without a booking agent, nothing. 300 million, that's almost the size of the USA. And I guarantee most of your listeners have had something forwarded to them that, you know, at some point in time they didn't know it was me. But, you know, it's just a really, really big honor to be able to carry some kind of torch for the conservative cause.
Well, no kidding. And you're personally conservative. This isn't a put-up where you're just saying, well, I'll be conservative, so I'll hit that niche. This is where you're coming from. How do you write songs about something that aren't who you really are?
You know, it's the stuff that me and my buddies would say in our truck anyway together. It's the stuff we'd say around a bonfire anyway. And at a certain point, you're going, why is this not, you know, why is this not out there in the big airways? Why is this all private conversation? Because this is the way we all talk. Why don't we just make it louder? And that's kind of what it's become.
Well, because what I worry about is when we have the coastlines, you know, the right. I live on the left coast and there's the right coast. And a lot of the decisions about music and culture and everything else get made there, even though they're trying to cater to people for the entire country, allegedly.
Yeah. And, you know, they just don't spend any time outside of those big cities. And it shows. It's very, very obvious.
Well, it's sad because I have a feeling an awful lot of our popular culture is going to get wiped out. My wife and I hadn't for years watched the Christmas Story, right? Classic old movie, and we're watching it, and we get near the end of it, and they have the famous Chinese Christmas Chinese dinner, and the waiters come out to sing, and they're singing Jingle Bells, and I thought, boy, they'd never get away with making that today. And that's kind of a sad statement about everything. I mean, we rewrite history and rewrite all of our popular culture to meet what is the current politically acceptable woke way of doing things.
That is. And, you know, that's why I admire people like y'all way out there on the coast. I mean, you're on the front lines every single day. You got to drive through it. I don't. I mean, my state's as red as a tomato, so we're not feeling that kind of pressure. Whereas America is, you know, biscuits and gravy down here, and so are y'all. But and there's good people everywhere. That gets me so fired up when we talk to fans out there, you know, in New York City or Portland or Los Angeles, San Francisco. There's patriots everywhere, and I think if we looked around and we could all just wear a special T-shirt or something to make us feel like the sky's not falling, maybe that's one idea. I don't know.
Well, there are times where I look around and I think, and people have asked me, why do you want to be a conservative surrounded by liberals? And I said, well, you know, it is true. You can't swing a dead cat in the Pacific Northwest without hitting a liberal. On the other hand, this is where people need the message even more. I mean, down in Mississippi, they might say, yeah, that Buddy Brown, he's a little on the liberal side. He's not quite conservative enough for me. And I'm sure you get some of that.
I could take you to some places.
I'll bet. Well, I told people, I said the other thing that inspired me is the dog that spends the day. He's only about 15, 16 months old now, but he came, you know where Pontotoc, Mississippi is?
I do.
Now, that's where Sir Winston Churchill came from. Sir Winston hangs out in the studio with me all day long, and he came from, it was a long airplane trip from Ponta, well, a road trip up to Memphis, and then an airplane to Dallas and an airplane here, and he came out of it with his tail wagging. So he had the proper conservative attitude.
He's not a DOG, he's a DAWG.
Well, I want people to know where to find you, buddy, because the fact that Nashville has said you're not woke enough for us these days, where can they find you online?
YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, website is buddybrowncountry.com, all those places right there. But we're definitely trying to be one of the very few voices in country music, I can't believe I'm even saying that speaks out for the conservative cause, and they're never going to shut us down.
Well, we love the songs, and we're going to be using them, and with lavish credit to the author and the composer, Buddy Brown. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 21 years. Next year, we mark 22. Our Twitter poll today, is Oregon trying to hide the fact that it's planning to make COVID mask rules permanent? I know that's a complicated question. But you should understand that right now, the state of Oregon has emergency rules, which are only allowed to go on for 180 days, about 6 months. And then just about 2 weeks ago, we let you know that the state was going to propose to make the rules permanent so they don't have to renew them and re-justify them every 6 months. Well, I think there's a reason you have to re-justify them. You have to say, why should we have this rule? And you say, well, everybody else does. Well, no, they don't. There are 44 states in America that do not have outdoor mask rules or, indoor mask rules. The six or five that do are Nevada, Hawaii, California, and Washington State, and then Oregon. And until a couple of weeks ago, Oregon had an outdoor mask rule as well. It is that rare. 10% of America's states actually have indoor mask rules, and now Oregon wants to make them permanent. And all we get from the Brown administration, Queen Kate Brown has decreed that she wants to have these rules made permanent. And what she has is a bunch of sleazy bureaucrats like Dr. Paul Cieslak, who says, well, the fact that it's permanent, which is what the rule would be called if they make it permanent, does not mean it'll be in effect forever, which would be like saying, well, it's against the law to murder people today, but that doesn't mean that will always be the law. It might change someday. Yes, it might. But the fact that it might change someday means that I guess by that definition, every single rule, every single law, every single ordinance is not permanent by that explanation. The fact is they want to make it permanent. They no longer want to have to justify this. And then you had the fact that over this last weekend, Governor Kate Brown and the woman who wants to succeed her, Tina Kotek, who is going to run for the governor's job, both showed up at an LGBTQ event in Washington, D.C. And there were lots and lots of pictures of them in the crowd of people who were not wearing masks. And Kate Brown was not wearing masks. And her office officially responded by saying, well, she was wearing the mask except when she was either taking a photo with somebody or when she was eating. Well, unfortunately, there are a lot of photos that show she was not wearing a mask most of the time. So, and Tina Kotek wasn't either. So, is Oregon trying to hide the fact that it's planning to make the COVID mask rules permanent? This is the kind of cowardice we should not have in public office. If they want the rules to be permanent, whatever permanent means to you, as in effect till further notice, then go ahead and justify it and tell the public why. If you're uncomfortable with the fact that people are saying, are you trying to make this permanent? And use these sleazy definitions. Permanent means indefinite. It doesn't necessarily mean permanent. Well, the only things permanent in life are death and taxes and apparently mask rules as well. And these kinds of explanations saying, well, we could change the rules someday, in which case, if we change it 20 years from now or 50 years from now, it wasn't permanent after all. This is the kind of sleaziness you do not need from your government. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and also at LarsLarson.com and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to your calls now at 866-A-LARS. First to Michael. Michael, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Lars. I would put it to you that we should hold Fauci accountable for the mouse murders that he's perpetrated in collusion with the Chinese. I think that it is provable, and I think that I would appreciate it if somebody with a lot more pull and a lot more knowledge than I have would start to do something of that nature.
I've made the case, Michael, that he caused research to be done with American tax dollars in China that had been forbidden, believe it or not, by Barack Obama in the United States. He said, you can't do gain of function research here. So Fauci had it done overseas and he spent our money on it. And he taught the Chinese how to do gain of function with viruses. And the end result was COVID. So the case can be made. The problem is, Michael, You know who's in charge now? You've got Joe Biden,
yes,
allegedly the president. He's appointed an attorney general, Merrick Garland, who thinks it makes sense to go after parents for being too loud at school board meetings or being too insistent at school board meetings. So he's clearly not going to prosecute anybody. So in that case, and you've got a Congress that until next fall is controlled by the Democrats, and that the Democrats...
This is when we march en masse. We march en masse and demand these things, and people should come together of all walks of life and all religious backgrounds, and every sense of the word of humanity should go after these people that are turning our own government against us. And we need to get them out of office and out of the world, as far as I'm concerned, because they've got no place. They've got no business doing what they've been doing to all of us.
I don't disagree with you, Michael, although it would make me a bit of a hypocrite if I said all last summer when we saw masses of people protest, not huge numbers, but enough to get our attention, who were rioting in the streets of American cities and demanding defunding of the police. They got a lot of what they were asking for. Now, it's turned out badly, but the fact is, it's never been the way that conservatives do things, but it may be that that will be the only way we can get their attention. Glad to be with you. Glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277. You've got the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, which carries this show over 24 great radio stations all over Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We'll do that in just a moment. But I wanted to bring Paul Graves back on. I should call him Commissioner Paul Graves. He is one of the four redistricting commissioners in Washington State. And that means that every time we have a new census, which happens every 10 years, the redistricting commission can actually come up with a plan for the whole state. And I had such optimism, Paul, when you described the system where you said, well, we come up with a plan. And of course, the Democrats are going to want skewed, gerrymandered districts. But if you come up with a reasonable solution, we'll end up with a reasonable result from that. And instead, what we have is we have the Supreme Court stepping into it, which wasn't at all the idea of redistricting commissions, was it?
Well, sort of. And again, thanks for having me on and trying to sort through this kind of mess of what happened here. I will say that under at least Washington State, our commission is still a fair one. We have two Republicans, two Democrats. You have to have three votes for a map. There's a deadline, and if we don't meet the deadline, then it goes to the state Supreme Court as a fallback. How do I put it? We got our homework done. It was done on time, but we didn't turn it in on time. But the court last week decided that was okay, that it could have been done better to get the maps done earlier by our midnight November 15th deadline to have the actual maps themselves. But the court agreed that we had a framework in place that we used to draw those maps in place by that midnight deadline. And so the court essentially said, yes, you, the commission, did your job, and the maps that have been publicly available since the day after that meeting on the 15th, those maps are the maps that we adopted, and they're fair maps.
Look, this whole thing was when we talked about redistricting, there had to be the assumption, the founders of this country, it's going to be a political process, right? Because that's who makes the decision. Even if it's two Democrats and two Republicans, there's still going to be an inclination in the direction of saying, well, how can we make our side come out a little bit better? But when you described it, I want you to describe again so I don't get it wrong, that when you said, when we drew the maps and said, here's how the state's going to be divided up, that you do it based on geographic boundaries. You try to do it based on, you know, not saying, well, we're going to start with this city over here, like Oregon did, and have it go from Bend all the way to Portland with one district that has this long tentacle, like the world's largest octopus, so that we can get the right arrangement of Democrats and Republicans. You said the maps drawn up by the two Republicans created mostly competitive districts, and by competitive you meant, you know, roughly 50-50, not a big advantage for either party. And the Democrats drew something, I don't want to mischaracterize your Democrat colleagues, but they were drawing districts that were where they'd drawn it to the advantage of the Democrat Party. Am I right?
That part's entirely true, and you're certainly right. I mean, this this process of redrawing political boundaries is inherently political and partisan, and it always will be. The beauty of our system is that it at least forces the parties to talk to each other and get at least some buy-in from one person on the other side. So, yes, of course, Democrats were drawing proposed maps that would be good for Democrats. We were drawing proposed maps that would be better for Republicans. I mean, I also have the higher ideal of at least wanting a lot of competitive districts. And where we ended is where this process kind of forces you, which is something sort of in the middle. Again, these are, you know, the maps that we produced are, they are not the maps that I would have drawn. I wanted to have a lot more competitive districts, but we got more competitive districts than the status quo, and that's good. And I think ultimately, at the end of the day, these maps that we now have, I told you this, I think, last time we talked, I can't draw you a map that guarantees you a Republican majority in Olympia. And I certainly can't get a Democratic vote for that. But what I can do and can work for and what we ended up with are maps that if we do it right, if we have great candidates step up to bat, especially next year, if every Republican volunteers their time and their money, if those candidates run great campaigns, we have the chance to bring balance back to Olympia. And that's something that I think we should all want.
See, now I want to ask you something. When you said you got more competitive districts, so more 50-50s, where then the test is, if the voters listen and the district is roughly half and half, then it's whoever has the best ideas and presents themselves the best to the public is going to win. Right. And that's, I think, what anybody in a representative form of government would want. And that is the ideas get tested. Not, you know, I always use AOC's district in New York, you know, where she has a district that's something like 80% Democrat, which means you could take, you know, you could run Jesse Smollett as a member of Congress and he'd win because it's 80% Democrat. Oh, he's got a D in front of his name. OK, he's the next member of Congress. Who would want that kind of system where even the Democrats, if they, let's say you're a diehard Democrat and you say, we like Democrats. Okay, so any dummy who runs, no matter how bad a candidate they are, can win simply because the district is 80% Democrat? I don't think Republicans would like that either.
I think that part's right. And to be perfectly candid, I mean, there are some areas of our state that there's no way to draw it other than kind of that way. Like if you're drawing a district in Capitol Hill or you're drawing a district in Northeast Washington, those are going to be solidly Democratic and solidly Republican districts. And that's, you know, just the way that the geography falls, the way that we've sorted ourselves into partisan areas. But in the areas where we can draw them, and we want to make sure that we're respecting geographic boundaries and communities of interest, but if you can draw them that way in snare districts that are also swing districts, I just think that tends to be better for the reasons you're talking about. The better candidate, the person who works harder, the person who has the better ideas, usually tends to win. And then once they're in D.C. or they're in Olympia, they know they're going to have a hard test the very next time. And so they're going to be really responsive. They're going to have to listen to people who they might otherwise disagree with, but at least listen to them and give them a fair hearing so that everybody feels like they're heard. I think all those are really positive things. And that's why having a lot of competitive districts was my top priority.
I'm talking to Paul Graves, who's the one of four redistricting commissioners. Again, two Democrats, two Republicans. Can you tell us about the worst case, the worst scenario that was actually drawn into the maps from your point of view?
Yeah, but I can. And it has to do with math. We have a natural dividing line, obviously, in Washington along the Cascades, where you should just draw legislative boundaries on one side and the other. But if you add up all the population from the cities on the east side, other counties on the east side, and you divide by the number you need for every district, you get a remainder of 60,000 people. So no matter what you do, you have to draw a district that has about 60,000 people from the west side and about 90,000 people from the east side. And no matter how you do it, like if I were drawing it myself, no matter how you do it, it is going to be kind of a mess because it's such a natural dividing line. We ended up doing it over Highway 2, over Stevens Pass. And so you have a district that is like Northeast King County, Southeast Snohomish County, Chelan County, and Kittitas County. It's not naturally what you would put together. It's going to be, I think, hard to represent because you got a pass there that's closed sometimes, and you got people on both sides of the divide there. And that's probably the hardest district that we drew just from a community of interest point of view. And the only reason we did it is because the math requires you to do something like that.
Absolutely. That's Paul Graves from the Washington State Redistricting Commission. Paul, thanks very much for the time. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. We'll talk about a big recall going on in the city of Seattle. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. This segment brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details on that. Is the big turnout of voters in the city of Seattle because of either fans or foes of Seattle's socialist city council member, Shama Sawant? I was glad to see that the folks behind the recall finally beat all the court challenges. And now they say turnout, which, by the way, closing deadline is 8 p.m. tonight to get the votes in. Turnout is about 38% so far. And in fact, at this hour, it may be even a little bit higher than that. I'm anxious to see how this comes out and whether or not Shama Sawant has somehow engendered a lot of support or she just has a lot of opponents. I don't think this socialist belongs on the Seattle City Council. I don't think she brings much to the Seattle City Council. She's actually been on this show before. And if she, whether she survives or fails, I'm going to ask my producers if we can get Shama Sawant back on the program. I have a feeling if she does not succeed, if she is recalled, and that may well be the result, she may not want to come on and talk about it, but she could surprise me. And we're going to extend that olive branch anyway and say, come on and talk about this. And if she survives the recall, I'd love to talk to her even more, because then I'd like to know if they attempt to recall a public official and the public official manages to survive the recall, does the public official change his or her behavior at all so that it more closely meets what the constituents of that public official, you'd think they'd listen. It would be like an employee who gets into big trouble and the boss says, I'm suspending you for a day or 3 days without pay as a punishment for how you behaved. You would think that employee would come back to the job with an entirely different attitude. Will that be the case with Shama Sawant? I'm gonna ask her if we get the chance. And if she gets recalled, maybe she won't want to come on. In any case, your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's start with Zach. Hey, Zach, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, no, you were talking about Zach's before the mass before the hour.
Yep.
And I wanted to start by simply saying that I just spent a long weekend in Minnesota, which is a blue state, but no mass required. And it was glorious. Absolutely glorious. Right, we're vaccinated. Everybody's vaccinated, and everybody knows that masks aren't going to help you if you're already vaccinated.
And let's actually, the vaccine. In fact, let me ask you something, Zach. Since you mentioned that you're vaccinated, does the vaccine mean that much to you at this point? Knowing that if you're vaccinated, you can still catch COVID, you can still die of COVID, you can still get very sick of COVID, and you can still pass COVID to somebody else. How much confidence does being vaccinated give you?
For me personally, it never gave me much confidence because I'm not in a high-risk group. I'm very confident that given my age, my weight, my lack of comorbidities, that if I caught COVID, nothing bad would happen. I would have a cold.
And I have a feeling that's probably going to – well, you know, that's the result for the vast majority of COVID cases to begin with. Is that even at the very beginning of all this, a year and a half ago, we were telling people 80% of the cases are either asymptomatic or you'll feel lousy because like you had a bad cold, and another, say, 15%, you're going to get really sick and be home for a few days, and maybe 5% will go to the hospital, and 0.3% will actually die of the disease. And so you say, okay, so how much does the vaccine change that? I've wanted to test that for a while. And ask somebody in medicine who actually knows the answer. And here's the way I presented, Zach. If we know that the overall death rate is about 0.3%, okay, so if 1 million people catch COVID unvaccinated, then about 3,000 of that 1 million are going to die, right? All other things being equal. If they're vaccinated, how much does that reduce the deaths? Does it reduce it from 3,000 to 2,000? Does it reduce it to 1,000? Because I know for a fact it's not zero. Oregon isn't giving out the numbers anymore, but back in August, 25% of the people who died from COVID in Oregon in 1 month, 25% were vaccinated. And that made me want to say, well, if you tell me it reduces the chance of your dying, how much does it reduce the chance? Does that make sense?
Yep. Oh, yeah, those are all great questions. But I wanted to continue the question and go down what I think is some sneaky governing by Kate.
What's that?
So if I recall correctly, her emergency order ended at the end of June. And
then they renewed it.
I don't think they renewed it.
Well, the mask mandate's still in place, and they say that if they don't renew it, it will run out again. And I thought it ran out in February.
Right. So before the emergency ended, they put in the sneaky, temporary permanent rule for masks that allowed her to write letters to turn it on and off without referencing any emergency.
Right.
So now I think she lacks the political power to enact another emergency to renew the emergency order because there's no emergency in place.
Zach, I have a slightly different understanding, and this is based on the comments of Dr. Paul Cieslak. That's why we're asking the Twitter poll today, is Oregon trying to hide the fact that they want to make the COVID mask rules permanent? And you can find the question. It's at LarsLarson.com on Twitter and LarsLarson.com, our website. And what Cieslak says is that if we don't make it permanent, we're allowed to have the temporary rule for 180 days. That means every 180 days, they have to renew it. Does that make sense?
But then to renew it, I don't think he can renew it unless the governor has an emergency in place.
He says we can repeal it as well, but we're only allowed to have a temporary rule for 180 days, and anything that goes beyond 180 days, we cannot extend it. So you're right.
I totally agree with that's what he's saying, but what he's not saying is that he doesn't have the power to enact an emergency order unless the governor has an emergency in place.
Right, and she would have to do that, although it wouldn't surprise me one little bit if Kate Brown, especially since at this point she's kind of dangerous, Zach, because she's a lame duck governor. She can't run for office. Oh, she can run for office again. She can't run for governor again for a minimum of 4 years, and she apparently has no plans to do that, nor do I think it would be likely she'd get elected if she was out for 4 years. Although, who knows? If Tina Kotek becomes the governor of the state, that may be the best ad for Kate Brown's in other words, she'd be less bad than what I think Tina Kotek would be. Let me ask you one last thing, and that is, what do you make of the fact that the governor goes off to Washington, D.C. to a big public event and then doesn't wear a mask a substantial part of the time, even though in her own home state, she's demanding that citizens in her own home state, in the same kind of setting she was in Washington, D.C., should have to be masked up?
Oh, it's par for the course. We've seen it with multiple leaders, not just her, but the governor of Newsom and California and others.
Yep.
It's a two-tier society. They're in a special tier and the rest of us are not.
And the reason I ran some sound bites from Christine Anderson, who's a member of the European Union Parliament, and she's a conservative, and so she's apparently rare. She's from Germany, and she said, look, this is about controlling people, about breaking people, about saying you will comply with us. If you don't, you may find yourself, you won't be able to shop, you won't be able to go out in public, you won't be able to travel, you won't be able to do any of that. That very little of this is about controlling a disease, and almost all of it is about controlling people, and that free people should not tolerate that. Zach, thanks very much. I appreciate the call. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment. I want to talk about the Olympics for just a moment and about the fact that they should be boycotted by the United States for a whole number of reasons that all relate back to China's behavior around the world and in the world. The pandemic is one reason. Slave labor for manufacturing is another reason. And yet now the Biden administration has said, well, we're not going to boycott the Olympics. The athletes can still go, but we won't send any officials. So we're going to diplomatically boycott the Olympics. China, even though I don't think a diplomatic boycott is all that terribly important, saying, well, the athletes are still going to be there. China still gets the world stage of the Olympics being held in China. And the fact that a few U.S. officials are not going to show up doesn't seem all that terribly consequential to me. But China has now told the United States that it will, quote, pay for its diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Olympics on human rights grounds. The White House had announced yesterday it won't send any government officials to the Games in February of next year due to ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang and other human rights abuses. And the Chinese foreign ministry came back and said the U.S. will pay for its wrongdoing. You can wait and see. I thought we'd talk about that with Dr. Weifeng Zhang, who's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Dr. Zhang, welcome back to the program. And is it that terribly consequential that the United States says we're going to do a diplomatic boycott of the Games without actually holding the athletes back?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for having me again on the show.
Sure.
I think that's a very interesting question because it's really a hard decision to make. If you do a full boycott, which the U.S. actually did in decades ago with the Moscow Olympic Games, and in that scenario, even athletes weren't allowed to go. But it wouldn't be too fair to the athletes that who have made so much effort in preparation. But then I agree with you though. The diplomatic boycott is largely a symbolic gesture. I think it's a good thing to do, but it's pretty good as far as symbolic gesture goes. But it's really symbolic. That's what my take would be.
I mean, because it doesn't go far enough, is what you're saying. Am I right?
So I think if you go far enough, though, it's really hard to say empirically whether that would work in the sense of really changing Chinese behavior. The last time the U.S. did a full boycott of the Soviet Union, it was because of the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan.
Yep.
Did that change anything? It
nope.
Did not, right? So China is not going to abandon its forced labor practice and all these atrocities that you mentioned correctly, rightly so. But China is not going to change the behavior. So I think it's not going, in the end of the day, at the end of the day, it's not going to matter too much. The upside, I think, is to make American people talk more about all these atrocities in China to raise the public awareness. I think that's actually a good thing.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dr. Zhang, let's go back the other direction. What if the White House had instead said, no, you know what? We are going to send government officials. We're going to send a ton of government officials. In fact, we're going to send a bunch of our conservative. We're going to send Ted Cruz. We're going to send Louis Gohmert. We're going to send some real conservatives. And while they're there at the Games, they'll be making comments to American news media, which means it'll get back here and it'll get to the rest of the world. And we'll use it as a platform to speak out against what China is doing. I mean, to the extent that holding back the athletes is not going to change anything. That means holding back the diplomats isn't going to change anything either. Would it be smarter to go the other direction and say we're going to send people and they're going to spend a lot of their time while they're talking about the Olympics also mentioning the genocidal crimes of the Chinese?
I love your idea, Lars. I think that would be a good idea. And in fact, it's actually better than the athletes, American athletes doing that or making political statements on the, the Olympic platform, because sometimes it would lead to repercussions by, say, Olympic committees, even whether it's an international level or on the national level. And so for athletes, it's hard to do. But for politicians, sure, send more. I think that's actually a good idea. But
in fact, go ahead, Doc.
Oh, I wanted to also mention that it's really depends on what the ordinary Chinese people can see, and whether when conservative politicians make a statement, would that be broadcasted nationwide? And with all these media controlled in China, I think only very limited messages would actually be able to go through, even if we send politicians to China.
Dr. Zhang, let me ask you about that. I know China contains or has fairly good control of most media within its country. They control the internet, they control the broadcast networks. But is that as effective as it has been, recently, or is that a leaky kind of system where you end up with things getting through to the Chinese people either? Anyway, because I know that every time you put up a blockade of some kind on the internet, people, smart people, usually find a way around it. And I would imagine that there are people in China who say, I really want to see what's being said about my country around the rest of the world. Are the Chinese able to actually still control most of what the people see?
Yeah, I think a small fraction of the Chinese population
more highly educated ones and tech-savvy ones will be able to get around that, because in order to actually access information on the outside, including watching your show, for example, involves actually jumping the internet great firewall that the Chinese government put up. And doing that will involve a lot of getting around the technological difficulties. And the Chinese government never stopped cracking down on all these available means sometimes. So a very well-known method would be the virtual private network, or VPN. And the Chinese government constantly cracked down on VPNs by which some educated people can actually get around and see the outside world. So, but nevertheless, I think more and more people are being more aware of what's happening, really happening in China through the global internet. But it's a little better than where I, for example, where I grew up in China. I may have mentioned it to you when, June 4th Tiananmen Square massacre happened, but I didn't really know it until 17 years later when I actually got out of mainland China. So the information control and propaganda has really been very effective, the baseline that is for decades.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've got one other wild idea. Did you see that Enes Kanter, the basketball player, had become an American citizen? Do you see the stories about him?
Yes.
He's been a real outspoken, advocate for freedom. And in fact, one of the things he did was he formally changed his name to Enes Kanter Freedom. And then he became an American citizen, and he was able to, take the oath of citizenship by saying, "My name is Enes Kanter Freedom." I think we should nominate him as America's unofficial ambassador to the Olympic Games in China, and take up a collection and send him over there and have him. I mean, because he'd draw a crowd, first of all, he'd draw a lot of media, secondly, and they wouldn't be able to control what he says. And he'd talk about it there, and he'd still talk about it here.
Right. I think that might actually work to some extent. But the one method of media control, information control in China, was that sometimes things that got broadcasted on national television, it has a few seconds of delay. And so whatever happened in real time that the Chinese government doesn't like, it could actually cut it off and then show some, commercials so that people can ordinary Chinese people watching TV at home would not be able to see that. So I think it's an interesting, innovative idea. It would still run into some information control tactics by the Chinese government.
Boy, it's just sad, and especially when we realize that America and some of the other Western countries seem to be aiming in that direction as well, although the censorship seems to come more from the private companies that run the social media sites than it does from our official government. But if the effect is the same, the effect is still there. Back in a moment, 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go to the head of the line on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I wanted to get something off my chest, and it had to do with an incident that happened yesterday. There was a carjacking, except it wasn't just a carjacking. It was a man who carjacked. Now, they say allegedly carjacked. He's dead. It's never going to be established in court whether he did this or not, but apparently he did. There will be an investigation. This man in North Portland jacked a car and shot at a woman in one of the cars on the freeway when he drove onto the freeway going the wrong direction on Interstate 5. So he carjacks a car at gunpoint. He then steals the car, apparently carjacks another car. Then he ends up on I-5 going the wrong direction. You can easily understand why there were a number of people who could have ended up dead. A police officer could have ended up dead because the man was armed. The woman who was shot in one of the cars on the freeway could have ended up dead. My understanding is she is expected to survive. At the end of all this, the police confronted the man, or were able to confront the man, and they killed him, which I thought was the right result. If you make yourself that, and I know there are people out there saying, Lars, that's not, you shouldn't say you're glad the guy is dead. If somebody is so dangerous that they will steal a car at gunpoint or at weapon point, I don't know what kind of weapon he had, and they haven't identified him yet. I don't know what his criminal history is, but my guess is it's not going to be a clean criminal history. I'm willing to bet that when they finally identify him, as of an hour or so ago, they had not yet identified him. I'm sure they will fairly soon. His body is at the medical examiner's office. This is a dangerous guy. So what do you get? You get the mayor of Portland, who comes out, and what does he say? A violent series of events, not crimes, a violent series of events was stopped by Portland police. This is on Monday. And I'm saddened for the life that was lost. Now, right there, I stopped in my tracks and I thought, the mayor is sad that a guy who put multiple lives at risk is dead. I'm not. He chose his own end. He chose his end by committing a violent crime and then apparently committing another violent crime and then committing another violent crime. And when he could have said, I'm going to put my hands in the air, I'm going to put whatever weapon I've got on the ground, he chose not to do that. He chose to die. And you're sad that he died. I'm not, and I'll tell you why. This is an armed criminal who carjacked and shot at least one person. He fled the wrong way down a major freeway, which could have ended very badly. And he chose to get shot instead of giving himself up. I'm glad the police can shoot that well. I'm glad that this guy is gone. And I would suggest to you that the social justice warrior Mike Schmidt, the district attorney in the jurisdiction where this guy did this crime in Multnomah County, he wouldn't have done anything to this guy. In fact, if the guy fit into any one of a number of categories that the woke seem to care so much about, whether sexual, gender, skin color, whatever, social justice warrior Mike Schmidt probably would have done his best to minimize the crimes of this guy, to excuse them because of other factors he can't control, like economics or politics or race or whatever. And the end result of that would be the guy would get back out on the street, probably in time to do more crimes. So I'm glad the guy is gone. Add to that, that in the town I live in, Vancouver, Washington, this morning, a guy, well, tried to carjack this man's car. The victim saw, as he's being attacked by this guy who's trying to steal his car, the suspect tries to pull something out of his pocket. It turns out to be a knife or at least a sharp-edged weapon. And the suspect ends up getting stabbed by the victim in the crime, which I think is a really good result. He managed to shove the object into the suspect's stomach twice. The police are now looking for somebody who's got a gut wound somewhere because he managed to get away with his cohort. They drove away in a truck. This is the kind of Northwest that we've got right now, where police have been diminished. We've cut the police down because of the mob in the streets demanding defunding the police. We've got prosecutors who won't prosecute. I hope the new city attorney for Seattle, Ann Davidson, is actually going to change that. But Mike Schmidt in Multnomah County is not going to change that. He's shown no signs that he's going to change. And the end result is just getting in your car could literally put your life at risk. So to your calls now, let's go to Jack. Hey, Jack, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Well, I want to talk about the mask, you know, wearing the mask.
Yeah.
You know, I've had to wear them. I'm a blue-collar worker. And years ago, down in the Bay Area, Antioch, I had to go in refineries. And I had to wear full-face mask or part-time mask to take inspections of any unit. And I'm going to tell you, you know, back then I was making $25 an hour. You're working for Shell Oil. And you go in, you take your safety test. It might be 8 hours. And then you take a drug test.
Yeah, you're going to have to finish.
And they have a card with a locked gate. And you go in there, and they can sniff your car for any darn thing, for firearms. They can sniff for spent bullets or empty beer cans.
This segment of the show is brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. Find them at MarqueeHotTubs.com.